I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Daniel Lieberman. He's a professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard University. He's author of the book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. And he will be giving a talk this Thursday, the 7th of May, called Why Exercise is Really the Best Medicine. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much.
So you write about adaptation, what evolution has adapted us for, and how often there's a mismatch between what we're adapted to do as human beings and how our lives are now. First of all, one of the important points that you make is that we're not really even adapted to be healthy per se. We're adapted to reproduce as much as possible healthy children. What does this mean for people who are living in a world where we don't necessarily want to do a whole lot of reproducing? Some of us don't want to reproduce at all, and we want to live long and very healthy lives.
Well, it's our bodies, regardless of what we want them to do, are shaped by, you know, millions, billions of years of selection. And so much of how our bodies function and how our bodies respond to the environment as we grow and develop and age are shaped by those evolutionary forces. So it's important to recognize that, for example, although there's a lot of things that we do to improve our health, for example, and our well-being, sometimes those run counter to adaptations, and sometimes just because because our ancestors did something doesn't mean it's necessarily healthy for us. My point really is that the term adaptation, the concept of adaptation, is really complicated, and if we want answers to how to live healthier lives, we need to embrace that complexity rather than ignore it.
When you say we do things that we think are healthy but that run counter to what we're adapted to do, what are some examples of that?
Well, I mean, take, for example, the paleo diet, which I'm probably going to irritate some people. But, you know, we have this idea that, there are a lot of people out there who think there's an optimal diet, a perfect diet. And there are huge debates about it, right? For everybody from vegans at one end to, you know, paleo diet folks at the other end. And the fact of the matter is that every diet has features that are important for life and health, but also has trade-offs. Everything involves trade-offs. Every time you do something, you don't do something else. So we are, for example, adapted to put on fat and to be hungry. And we're adapted to, when we exercise, to be hungry again and to try to avoid exercise following that. Those are all ancient, deep adaptations, and it's very hard for us to overcome them for the sake, for example, of being thin. So I guess I didn't really answer your question very well, but, like, for example, I'm sitting in a chair now. In many ways, it's adaptive. I'm saving energy, which I could otherwise be wasting, and I could, you know, devote that energy, say, towards reproduction, which I can guarantee you I'm not. But on the other hand, we're also told that sitting, you know, is bad for us. It increases inflammation in the body. It can lead to tight hips. Everything has trade-offs. There's no perfect way to live your life. That doesn't exist.
Let's talk for a moment about the paleo diet, because that inevitably comes up. This idea that we should all be eating meat, fruits, and vegetables and nuts, things that were available before the dawn of agriculture. Implicit in that proposition is the idea that we haven't evolved at all since the dawn of agriculture. Is that true?
Well, of course it's not true. I mean, for example, I had milk this morning with my breakfast, and I'm able to digest the milk because my ancestors, since the origin of agriculture, evolved genes, mutation in one of my genes that it enables me to continue to produce lactase, the enzyme that digests lactose, as an adult. So, you know, natural selection didn't stop at the end of the Ice Age. It's true, of course, that there's not been that much selection over the last few hundred thousand years relative to what happened before. But evolution is a constant dynamic thing. It's still going on. But to me, that's not the real issue with the paleo diet. I mean, there are many good things about the paleo diet. And in general, it promotes a low-carb diet. And, you know, there's a lot of reason to be concerned about the high amounts of starch and sugar that people consume. And so that's a good thing about the paleo diet. But first of all, there was no one paleo diet. Human ancestors lived all over the planet and many different kinds of environments, and they ate a wide range of diets. You know, which one are we adapted for? An Eskimo diet? A diet that the Hadza eat in East Africa? A diet that the Aceh hunter-gatherers eat in the Amazon? I mean, which is the right paleo diet?
Right.
And in addition, remember that those paleo diets, again, those diets, again, are not selected for, or people's bodies are not selected for to make, to necessarily promote life and longevity and good health when you're 70 or 80. What gets selected for, inevitably by selection, is are features that improve reproductive success. So, you know, we're not necessarily adapted to be healthy, and just because our ancestors ate it is not reason that you should necessarily eat it. There's much more to it than that. And of course, that's not what everybody who espouses the paleo diet argues, but it often gets used in this kind of simplistic way that I think leads to some, you know, profound misconceptions. And finally, you know, let's be honest, we can't feed the entire world on grass-fed beef.
Right.
You know, we have 7+ billion people to feed, and we're not going to do it without feeding them primarily rice, corn, wheat, and other cereals. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, it does seem to me sometimes like there's almost a kind of Garden of Eden mythology embedded in that concept, that there was one true, beautiful, and healthy past that we can all somehow recapture, which, as you say, is very far from the truth.
No, and not only is it far from the truth, I mean, yes, there's no question that there are many aspects of health that declined with the origins of agriculture. No argument there. But we are actually healthier today, as a whole, as a species, than we've ever been, largely because of sanitation and medicine and other advances, at least those of us who are fortunate enough to live in developed countries, such as the United States. Could we do better? Absolutely. But it doesn't mean that the Paleolithic was this sort of glorious time period when nobody ever got sick and nobody ever got injured.
Right.
That said, a lot of the diseases that people are getting today are mismatched diseases. They're diseases that our ancestors didn't used to get. And by equal measure, one of the false conceptions that we have out there is that the reason we're now getting cancer and heart disease and osteoporosis and diabetes is that essentially these are the byproducts of success. As we live longer, we're more likely to get these diseases. That's partly true, but only partly true, because, for example, you know, there's pretty good evidence that heart disease is much, much, much more rare among people who are subsistence farmers or hunter-gatherers. They don't have rises in their blood pressure, for example, as they age, as do most Americans. There's good evidence that cancer rates, at least certain kinds of cancers, are much more common today than they used to be. Type 2 diabetes used to be extremely rare. So there's a lot of diseases that we're getting, not because we're living longer, but because of the way in which our bodies are poorly adapted to the lifestyles that we currently live. And those are what we call mismatched diseases. And I would argue that we can have the best of both worlds, but that requires paying attention to our evolutionary history.
Now, is there a conversation going on between evolutionary biologists like you and physicians?
Oh, absolutely. There's a burgeoning, sort of exploding new field called evolutionary medicine. In fact, the first big international conference was held just about a month ago in Arizona. And indeed, the field of evolutionary medicine attempts to use evolutionary theory and evolutionary data to address questions of health and disease. And, you know, it's still a small movement compared to much of what else is going on in medicine, but it's a growing conversation, and I guarantee you will become increasingly important. At least I hope so, because, you know, we spend too much resources in the world today trying to treat diseases that are preventable, and prevention partly requires understanding why a disease occurs in the first place. And that's where evolution plays such a vital role, because it helps us explain why we are the way we are.
So let's look at some of the big diseases that are caused by these, what you call a mismatch between our evolutionary nature and our not only agricultural but also really industrial society in which we live. Two big ones are diabetes and obesity. Why do we crave things that are bad for us in large quantities and make ourselves sick with those diseases?
Well, let's start with obesity, because that's the root of a number of issues, a number of problems. We are, you know, fat is energy, right? Fat is our body's way of storing energy efficiently. And there's nothing wrong with fat. Fat is actually good and healthy. And we are, as a species, actually remarkably fat. Average primates, adult primates out there, are about 8% body fat. And when they're born, they're about 3% body fat. Hunter-gatherer babies, right? Healthy human babies for most of human evolutionary history were about 15% body fat when they're born. Average hunter-gatherer adult males are about 10 to 15% body fat, and average adult females are 20 to 25% body fat. So even thin human beings are extraordinarily fat compared to other species. And the reason for that is that fat plays an important role in our evolutionary, in our life history, in the way we grow and develop and function. We need a larger reservoir of energy on board in order to pay for our brains, for example, which are very expensive. The average human brain costs your body about 20 to 25% of its basic basal metabolic rate, and the brain doesn't store energy, so you constantly have to supply the brain with energy, even when you're in negative energy balance, when you're dieting or don't have enough food. And if that's going on for several days or weeks, you have to have a lot of energy on board to pay for that extremely thirsty, power-hungry brain, which always needs food or you die. Our reproductive strategy also requires a lot of energy. You know, human mothers, you know, normally before the modern era, would nurse their children for about 3 years, right? And producing breast milk is very costly. It costs about, you know, increases a woman's energetic cost by about 20 to 25%. Well, you have to keep doing that even if you're, again, in negative energy balance, in case you're not getting enough food in, right? So you have to be able to have large amounts of fat to kind of tide you over during periods when resources are scarce. And then finally, I've made the argument that humans evolved to be endurance athletes. Average hunter-gatherers walk, you know, 5 to 10 miles a day, every day. Even when they don't have enough food, they have to do that kind of long-distance walking in order to get food. So you have to be able to do those sorts of things when you're in negative energy balance. And having plenty of fat on board is vital for that. So we face strong selection in our evolutionary history to crave foods that are very energy-rich, that we can store them whenever possible as fat, and to be, you know, relatively fat compared to other animals.
And at the same time, in nature, those foods that give us that extra fat are relatively scarce. So the idea that you could eat a pound of chocolate or the equivalent thereof, that didn't really exist in our evolutionary history.
Oh, unimaginable, right. Yeah, so the most desired food among hunter-gatherers in Africa is honey. Right? I mean, they crave what we crave. We're all humans, right? We love sweet things. But honey is not it's not easy to get honey, and you have to go find some bees and smoke them out and climb trees, etc. But today, of course, we have access to calories. You know, to get a few hundred calories is trivial. I just walk down to the, you know, soda machine in the basement of my building, and bam, I can get a few hundred calories for you know, no effort whatsoever. So we've created an environment where we can finally satisfy those urges and those cravings, which used to be very adaptive when resources were scarce, and now, of course, they've become maladaptive, and that's the essence of a mismatch disease. But we also have to be careful about fat, because we you know, you can be fat and healthy, and we often demonize fat in the wrong way and think about it incorrectly. There are different kinds of fat, and the more we study fat, the more we realize that what really matters the most in terms of health is not the fat that you store underneath your skin or in your buttocks or places like that. It's the fat that you store around your organs in your gut, what's called so-called visceral fat or belly fat or abdominal fat. That fat is actually sort of a short-term energy storage depot that we've evolved, like other animals, to use. It has some benefits, right, but it also has some enormous costs. And when we have a lot of it, we're much more susceptible to diseases like type 2 diabetes, because that kind of fat causes inflammation and leads to heart disease and to a lot of the a lot of the serious obesity-related diseases that we care about. So I think we spend way too much time worrying about how much people's weight are, and what we should really be concerned about is where the fat in their body is. And that's why exercise is so important, because if I go for a run this afternoon, it's not necessarily going to help me lose that much weight, but it will help me burn the fat that's in my abdomen, right? My ectopic or belly or my organ fat, because that's the first fat to get burned. So there are enormous benefits that come from exercise in terms of not necessarily in losing fat, but in redistributing fat into much more healthy ways.
Now, you became a long-distance runner yourself. Was that connected to your work as an evolutionary researcher?
Oh, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, I've always loved running. I started running when I was a kid, long before I had any inkling I'd study evolution. So, but I've written a lot about and done a lot of research on the evolution of running. And I will say that helped kick my running to another level, because I got, you know, as I was working on this research and doing more research and studying runners, I got more interested in it and and it sort of affected how I did it, and how I did it affected my interest, and it kind of became a positive feedback loop, basically.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a moment, because, I mean, human beings evolved to stand and walk on 2 feet instead of 4, and as you write in your book, we are considerably slower and weaker than our closest primate relatives, but what advantages do we have by standing, walking, and running on our 2 feet?
Well, I mean, that's changed over time. So we think that the initial advantage that outweighed the disadvantages, as you say, of being slow and unsteady, is that it helped us save energy. So chimpanzees, our closest relatives, spend 4 times as much energy walking as we do, either on all fours or bipedally, because of the way they walk with very bent hips and bent knees. So when we became bipedal, and since we think we evolved from an ancestor that was probably a knuckle walker like a chimpanzee, that's somewhat debated, but I think there's firm evidence to support that. But anyway, if you can save energy while doing that, particularly in the context of environmental change that was going on at that time, because we know that Africa was cooling, forests were fractionating, our ancestors had to walk farther in order to get food. If you can walk farther on the same amount of energy, and, you know, 4 times is quite a lot, that would have been an enormous selective benefit. Of course, then later on, that led to other benefits, such as the ability to use our hands for tools, for carrying, for all sorts of other things that we do very well. That was probably not the initial selective benefit, but it eventually became also an important consequence of being bipedal.
Now, you work with an amazing collection of bones at Harvard University, and one of the things that you've seen is that hunter-gatherers have excellent dental health. Why is that?
Yeah, well, you know, it's normal to have plaque on your teeth. So, you know, when you go to the dentist and they remove all that plaque. That plaque is a kind of thin film that contains lots of bacteria. And that's normal. Your dog has it, you have it, every animal on the planet has it pretty much. The problem is that the bacteria in plaque like to eat sugar and starch. So when we eat diets that are high in simple carbohydrates, so sugars and simple starches, right, bacteria happily munch away, eat those foods, and then produce as a byproduct acid, which gets trapped, of course, in that plaque and causes our teeth to develop cavities. So it wasn't really until we started having high amounts of sugar and starch in our diet that people were able to get cavities on a regular basis. So if you look at fossils from the old days, or even before agriculture, you know, it's just very hard to find cavities. They exist, but they're just much less common. And once people started eating cereals and grains and getting access to lots of simple carbohydrates, the percentage of cavities just went up, skyrocketed. And, of course, it isn't until fairly recently, with advent of modern dentistry, that we've been able to kind of get that under control to some extent. But that's another classic example of a mismatch disease, but it's also an example of why not all mismatch diseases are necessarily bad, because think of the alternative. We could prevent all cavities, right, by simply preventing all children from ever having any bread and rice and candy and and not only would our children hate us, right, but also we wouldn't be able to feed the world that way. So, you know, I think most of us agree that the price we pay in terms of having to go to the dentist is well worth it, given the benefits we get from agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, there's this continual ongoing dynamic of making progress, if we can call things like agriculture progress, and then paying the price for progress, and then figuring out ways to compensate for the negative consequences like cavities or obesity or whatever. And there are just so many mismatched diseases. I mean, you talk about diabetes, obesity, cavities. What are some of the other ones that are preventable if we think about things from an evolutionary perspective?
Well, I mean, yeah, you just mentioned a few. I mean, type 2 diabetes is such an obvious example, right? It's caused by a combination of diet and exercise, and until recently, it's an extremely rare disease, and it's growing rapidly. But we could prevent almost, you know, most of the cases of diabetes that are currently occurring. But it's a political issue. It's a public health issue that has its origins in evolution. But there are plenty of others. I would argue that this growing autoimmune diseases that are on the rise are mismatches. And they're complicated ones because we have immune systems that are adapted over millions of years to protect us from various pathogens, both organisms like worms, helminths, for example, but also various bacteria, etc. And you and I still have more or less the same immune systems that our great-great-great-grandparents had, but the problem is that we live in very sterile environments. And in addition, we also use a lot of antibiotics. How often have you had courses of antibiotics to deal with ear infections or throat infections or this, that, or the other? Those antibiotics can save lives. There's no question about it. I'm not opposed to antibiotics. Please don't misunderstand me. But misuse of those antibiotics or overuse of those antibiotics also has costs. And one of those costs could be explained by the increase in various autoimmune diseases from like inflammatory bowel disease, for example, that used to be extremely rare, colitis, celiac disease. These are modern diseases that are caused by our immune system basically being poorly adapted to the environments to which they now experience. But can we do better? I mean, I think we can. We can, by taking an evolutionary approach to antibiotics and thinking about our guts and the microbes that live in our guts from an ecological evolutionary perspective, we can restore their health. That's an evolutionary perspective. That comes from evolution, the idea of understanding what's a normal, natural, microbial environment inside our own bodies.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it that people who grow up on farms and running around in the dirt and playing with animals are much less likely to have, for example, allergies?
That's correct. It's enormously true. They also have their stress response, their immune response to stress is very different. So if you were to get an infection tomorrow, your innate immune system would mount an inflammatory response to that infection, right? People who grow up with more sort of more normal, natural, from an evolutionary perspective, ecologies, experience much less of that inflammatory response to that stress than you and I do, because they have a sharp, more rapid peak of that immune system, but then it dies off much more rapidly. But those of us who grew up in more sterile conditions get less of an immediate peak, but it lasts much, 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 much longer, and so we have much more chronic inflammation because of our immune systems were sort of programmed as children, and we're sort of stuck with them, apparently, for the rest of our lives. And we pay a price for that because a lot of the diseases that we worry about, including type 2 diabetes, heart disease, maybe even some forms of dementia like Alzheimer's, could be related to immune function, to inflammation, that, again, are this complex result of the way we use our bodies and the sort of ancient immune systems that we inherited.
Now, when somebody's immune system is programmed in childhood in a way that's not so good and not well suited to the way we evolved, can anything be done in adulthood to treat or reverse or change that?
I don't know. There's obviously lots of people working on it. I don't do immunology, so I'm not sure how trainable the system is in adulthood, to be honest.
Yeah.
That's a great question. I'm sure there are people working on it, but I don't know the answer to that.
Well, let's talk for a moment about stress. I mean, presumably we evolved in a high-stress environment in the sense that surviving in nature is probably not stress-free. So talk about stress. What is that stress that we evolved in like compared to the stresses that we experience now, because we all seem to be so unhappy when our lives are stressful?
Well, so you're talking about psychological stress first. So you're talking about being that state of alert that comes from being upset or concerned or worried about the world around you. Well, first of all, we don't have good data about what stress levels were like in the Paleolithic. I mean, nobody knows. But there's a lot of reasons to believe that actually they've gone up since the Paleolithic. For one, again, the burden of infectious diseases has risen enormously. Rates of aggression and violence have increased since the Paleolithic. We have lawyers, which we didn't used to have in the Paleolithic, commuting, grades. I mean, and furthermore, famine and war. These are things that hunter-gatherers don't experience. Hunter-gatherers, although they sometimes go through food shortages, they're not as severe as what farmers go through because they just move. They move to other parts of the environment where the foods are available. They switch to other kinds of foods. But when farmers experience a drought, I mean, there's nothing for them to eat, and they die by the droves. Hunter-gatherers live in smaller population densities. They don't have as much property. They treat each other more nicely. They don't use women as property, for example. So there's lots of reason to believe that stress has actually gone up in the modern world and continues to go up. I mean, commuting, for example, classic source of stress, very well studied. the more you commute, the more stressed you are. And, of course, what stress elicits is a hormonal response, and the major stress hormone that goes up is cortisol. Cortisol doesn't make you stressed. Cortisol goes up when you are stressed, and cortisol is that response is adaptive. If a lion is chasing after you or there's a famine, you know, that cortisol response makes you more active. It mobilizes energy. It helps you move fat from subcutaneous stores to those visceral stores, which so you can actually access it rapidly. It gives you food cravings. But you can immediately appreciate that in the modern era, chronic stress, chronically elevated levels of cortisol are disastrous for our health because they increase inflammation, they increase visceral fat stores, they wreak havoc on our bodies in a variety of ways because, again, it's chronic, because it's unceasing, never ending. And then we get into these vicious feedback circles. So a good example is lack of sleep. So if I didn't sleep very well last night, my cortisol levels would have been elevated today. And that helps me kind of get through the day and cope with that stressful lack of sleep. The problem is, though, that elevated cortisol then makes me less likely to sleep tonight, makes me more likely to have cravings in the middle of the night. So I go down to the refrigerator in the middle of the night. It's going to shunt fat to my visceral stores, which are going to increase inflammation levels in my body. So you can immediately appreciate there's all kinds of pernicious negative effects of chronic stress that are really problematic. And so I think that's what most people think, is that, yes, stress used to exist in the Paleolithic, but short-term stress is adaptive. Long-term chronic stress is highly maladaptive.
You were giving a talk here in Santa Fe about how exercise is the best medicine. And what are some ways in which exercise not only maintains our health, because everyone knows that, but actually heals us from illness?
Oh, gosh. It's kind of hard to know where to start. I mean, the benefits of exercise is really necessary for almost every system of our body. It has, for example, enormous effects on the immune system. Exercise lowers levels of inflammation that are so pernicious and so responsible for so many diseases. Exercise helps us build stronger skeletons and helps us prevent losing that skeletal mass as we age, so preventing osteoporosis. Exercise is probably, almost surely, the best way to fight against heart disease. People who exercise have stronger hearts and lower blood pressure, and they're much less likely to get both cardiovascular disease that result from high blood pressure, from hypertension, as well as those that result from atherosclerosis, the formation of plaques in our arteries. It's important for mental health. The number one predictor of whether or not you get Alzheimer's is actually how much exercise you had. That's more important than anything else. It's relevant to cancer. Women who exercise more have substantially, maybe as much as 30 to 40, maybe even higher percent, lower chances of developing breast cancer because it's, again, energy that gets shunted away from reproduction. It's very hard to find evidence for systems of the body that are not importantly affected by moderate to vigorous exercise.
Including clinical depression.
That's correct, yeah. So exercise upregulates neurotransmitters in the brain that are crucial for protecting against depression and anxiety as well. So both serotonin and dopamine are upregulated by exercise. Also, other growth factors called brain-derived neurotrophic growth factors, BDNFs, which actually maintain the health of neurons and promote the growth of new neurons. So it's one of the major ways in which you promote cognitive function and brain health is through exercise. The ancients weren't crazy when they said that a healthy body is a healthy mind. It's absolutely true. And yet, I should also say, so rarely do when people go see a doctor, does the doctor ask them how much exercise they're getting, and that includes mental health professionals. You know,
yeah.
A great way of ADHD and depression and anxiety, and I'm not saying we shouldn't treat them in other ways, but I don't understand why exercise is not the most basic fundamental component of most more mental health treatments. It's, to me, astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, they could write that on their prescription pad, and it's free.
It's free, and it's incredibly beneficial, not just for mental health, but for everything else. But we live in a world where it's very hard to exercise, and once you're unfit, it's a drag, right? It's difficult. And then we have, as a society, we tend to be very judgmental against people who don't exercise, and often it's not their fault. So we as a society, as a culture, need to figure out ways to help each other better without pointing the finger. And I think that's one of the reasons doctors are so unwilling to prescribe exercise, because there's stigma associated with being unfit. And, you know, going to the gym and you're unfit and you huff and you puff and you're horrible, you know, you don't get any positive feedback from it. So we as a society have to figure out ways to help each other in ways that that we have so far, I think, failed to or not done as well as we should.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that so many of us go through this, you don't want to exercise because you've gotten into a sedentary mode and so many of our jobs are sedentary. And then you start exercising and this moment comes over where you flip into liking it, enjoying it, wanting it, and needing it. And the same thing with food. I mean, you go through periods where you eat 73 chocolate bars in a week. And then after a while, if you start eating healthy, you start craving those healthy foods again. So it can go either way.
Absolutely. And we need to help people do that. We've been asked by our society, by our world, by advertisers and by the farm bill and by all kinds of other forces out there to have to make choices that we never evolved to make. If you have a stairway next to an escalator, it's absolutely normal, adaptive, from an evolutionary perspective, to want to take the escalator, right? It makes sense to save energy. We filled our world with all kinds of energy-saving devices because that's what we crave. That's what we want. Look, every time I walk into my building, I'm on the fifth floor of my building, I want to take the elevator. There's no question about it. I fight that battle absolutely every day. And the reason I usually take the stairs is because I don't want to be called a hypocrite. It's true. It's a useful nudge for me. But if I hadn't written a book about exercise and diet and health, you know, I might be less disinclined to take the stairs. So we have to figure out ways to help each other without being judgmental, and that's not easy when our world is also so filled with ways that just make it easy to avoid exercise. You know, shopping. You know, for example, you go to some airports, it's almost impossible to find any stairs. You have to take the escalator. Sometimes after a long flight, that's the last thing I want to do is take an escalator.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you one more thing. We evolved in nature where there was, I mean, let's put it this way. We didn't eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner, presumably, in nature. Or did we? I mean, is that a normal, healthy thing? Is that kind of routine something that comes naturally to us? Is that a cultural, evolutionary pattern?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Meals? Very, very normal, very basic. Hunter-gatherers eat meals together. Absolutely. They get up in the morning, they have remains of what left over from yesterday. They go out when they hunt and forage. They snack all day long, by the way. As you pick berries or dig up roots or kill things, you eat them as you go. But then they bring food back and share it at a camp. You know, so having dinner together and sitting together as a group, as a family, and sharing a meal and stories, that's millions of years old. That's fundamental. That's ancient. So sitting down for meals as a group, that's I think a fundamentally human thing.
Now, you write about evolution not just as a process that has led us up to the present moment, but a process that's ongoing, and human beings are still evolving, and all creatures are still evolving. Do you have a sense of what direction evolution is taking us? I mean, I would imagine it varies considerably from one society to another.
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between natural selection and cultural evolution. So natural selection is hard to predict, right? And furthermore, it's still going on for sure. But right now, the effects of natural selection are clearly being swamped by cultural evolution, right? We can come up with all kinds of cultural means to buffer ourselves or mediate or modify our environments and our genes. So it's very hard to predict what's going to happen for natural selection. At the moment, I don't think it takes a genius to figure out what's happening to our bodies because of cultural evolution. We're becoming more sedentary and fatter and more subject to chronic non-infectious diseases. It's beginning to plateau in places like the United States and other wealthy countries, but look at places like China or India or Brazil where diabetes is rising at astonishing rates. Obesity is going up at astonishing rates. You know, what happened in our society is now happening dramatically throughout the world, and it would be nice if we can, it's vital. Important. It's the right thing to do to help. Not only do we need help ourselves in our country and our society, but we need to help others from falling into the trap that we've fallen into. I mean, how is India going to pay for the 100 million diabetics they're going to have in the next 10, 20 years?
Right.
They can't afford that. The consequences for India are already enormous and are growing. Mexico, you know, Africa where I work. I mean, I work in an area of Africa where we're now seeing signs for diabetes clinics along the road. I mean, when I first started working there, I don't think diabetes was on anybody's radar screen.
So what kind of changes are necessary, whether they be policy or education or whatever, to prevent those diseases in these countries you're talking about, India, China, Brazil, Mexico?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's a $64 billion.
Yeah.
I mean, what we really need to do is focus on prevention. We all know how to prevent these diseases. It comes from eating a healthier diet, and which we all know what it is. It's mostly avoiding lots of sugar and foods that don't have fiber, eating more whole grains. And the other essential component of it is regular physical activity, particularly during childhood. And I think the key thing is to work on children, because once people are overweight, once they're unfit, it's very hard for them to get back to being normal weight and get back to being fit. So we should be focusing with passion our efforts on helping kids grow up to be healthy so that they can stay healthy. And it's so sad to see our inability to prevent kids from being essentially, you know, the number one vegetable children eat in the United States is French fries.
Oh, my goodness.
And legislation to try to fix that is fought tooth and nail in Congress. We have no problem legislating that children shouldn't smoke or children shouldn't drink. We figured that, or that children have to be in seatbelts. How is it any different to try to help children not be poisoned by too much junk food? You know, one kills you faster, the other kills you slower, but they're both bad for you. Most schools don't have enough physical education. We're allowing our kids to grow up without exercising, and they live in environments where it's hard for them to exercise. That's just not unconscionable, in my opinion. We really have to act together to help children grow up to have healthy bodies so they can do better. And by the way, it will also save us a lot of money, too.
Right. And enjoy themselves in the process, whether it's playing sports or dancing or climbing up a mountain. These things are fun. Not everybody likes all of them, but everybody likes one thing that requires movement.
Play is good.
Daniel Lieberman is professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard University. He is the author of the book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. And once again, he will be giving a talk this Thursday, the 7th of May, here in Santa Fe. It's called Why Exercise Really is the Best Medicine. It's at the New Mexico History Museum. It's sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. You can find out more on their website, sarweb.org. Daniel, thank you so much for being with us at the Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.